All right, our next matter on calendar this morning is 65199 Clark versus State. Do we have everybody here and ready to go?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, Mr. Waters, are you ready?
This court's indulgence.
Good morning, Your Honors. William Waters from the Clark County Public Defender's Office. I represent the appellant, Robert Clark. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Sure.
Mr. Clark was convicted in the Judicial District Court based on very circumstantial evidence. I don't know if this is the prime point of this appeal, but something has happened recently with this panel, actually, which I think makes my first issue regarding the bails instruction more important. And it's unpublished. It was an unpublished decision that came out very recently, and I'm sure Your Honors are all familiar with it. There was a murder trial going on in the 8th Judicial District Court. The state, I guess it was Judge Susan Johnson, had decided to give the bails instruction. And the state took a petition for writ of mandamus to this court, arguing that it was an incorrect statement of law. The defense shouldn't be entitled to that. Now, this court had an opportunity to review that, had an opportunity to say definitively that the bails instruction is an incorrect statement of law and that you are never entitled to it because you have the reasonable doubt instruction, but this court chose not to and actually said that if you give the bails instruction, then you have to give a more complete instruction than what was requested. In Mr. Clark's case, he requested the exact same language that was requested in the Sopranovich case. And the problem we have here is that bails is Nevada law, and it's still good law, and it's never been modified or changed, and it basically says that the court can give the instruction or not give the instruction, completely up to the district court. So, obviously, the court has some discretion to give it. Now, what happened here is at trial, the deputy district attorney advised the judge that that's an incorrect statement of law. It's a California law. It's a California instruction. This is not found anywhere in Nevada. They shouldn't be entitled to it. And Judge Vega agreed. She didn't say one way or the other if that was true or not, but she said, yeah, I'm going to agree with you, and you're not entitled to that instruction. So I do think that this is important, that in cases involving substantially circumstantial evidence, the bails instruction is important. Now, whether you get it or not, that's fine. That's decisions that district court judges get to make. The problem here is Judge Vega didn't exercise any discretion whatsoever. She abused her discretion because she said, essentially by adopting the state's reasoning, that this is not a Nevada law, or this isn't a legal principle in Nevada, so you're not entitled to it. Well, that's an arbitrary, capricious, or beyond the bounds of law reason, because it's actually
not. But Mr. Waters, quite often this court looks at things and decides someone is right for the wrong reason.
Okay.
And giving the standard reasonable doubt instruction up to the point in time you talk about was the normal position the court took when attempting to give a, I'll use the term conflicting, I know that's not from your standpoint conflicting, but a different version of the same instruction.
Right.
So at the time in question, without the foresight of the court taking this strange position, saying, well, in light of what's occurring, we're going to do this and see where it goes. In that case, the court still gave a proper instruction. So the question really comes down to, from your standpoint, arguing prejudice in this matter. How do you feel your defendant, Mr. Clark, was prejudiced by the failure to give this instruction?
And you're right, Your Honor. That's absolutely the point, because it's a jury instruction issue, so it's a harmless error standard. I do think Mr. Clark was prejudiced in this particular case because it was such a circumstantial case. You had no direct evidence whatsoever that puts him inside the apartment. And I understand that there's some suspicion there. There's a Blu-ray player found in the apartment, which he co-occupies, apparently, with three other people, and that he's standing on a balcony near the apartment. But the reality is, burglary is intent upon entry. So you've got to prove intent, you've got to prove entry. And since entry is one of the most essential elements of burglary, and there's no direct evidence of that, if the jury's instructed that if you only have circumstantial evidence and you have to sort of defer to the evidence because it would point towards innocence, I think the jury in this case very likely, had they been instructed that way, would have looked at it and said, yeah, I can't get to anything that sort of convinces me that he was actually inside that apartment. Because there's another individual on the balcony as well. And then in that sense, I think if they had been had they been instructed according to Vails, then I do think there's a strong possibility that the jury would have come back and acquit Mr. Clark.
Wasn't there an eyewitness here that identified Clark as one of the members trying to break into the apartment?
There was an eyewitness who identified Mr. Clark, not trying to break in. Now, what her testimony was that she saw him outside the window of Mr. I apologize, I forget the alleged victim's name, but his apartment window upstairs. He was outside the window, and then she later saw Mr. Clark walking, and he apparently had some sort of a pole or a stick in his hand. And I know I'm probably splitting hairs here, Your Honor, but you know, I'm a defense attorney, so when you say breaking in, there was...
I should have said attempting to open the window.
I'm sure my colleague from the district attorney's office would absolutely say that's what he was doing. I think the record bears out that it was more she saw him at the window, just sort of kind of hovering around the window. You know, I think reasonable minds can differ about what she saw. But yes, she did identify him as a person up on the balcony, or not at the balcony, I'm sorry, the second floor of the apartments near the window. But again, we're talking about burglary. Now, if this was an attempt burglary charge, I think this court would be completely justified in saying that Judge Vega had no obligation whatsoever to give a circumstantial evidence instruction pursuant to Vails. But burglary is a little bit different. If you're hovering around a window with a stick in your hand and the state charges you with attempt burglary, you know, that's pretty much direct evidence of attempt burglary, not circumstantial evidence. But burglary is very different, and it's entry and it's intent upon entry. And so because you have to prove entry, and there was no other forensic evidence, I think, that indicated he was inside the apartment. There was another individual on that second floor as well hanging around the apartment. So, yeah, I just don't think in this case there's any direct evidence of burglary.
Did trial counsel argue two reasonable theories?
I think once she asked for the instruction and was denied, I think she just merely argued, Your Honor, that sort of there was no evidence that he actually entered. There was other people involved. The cops didn't, I guess, really interrogate the other individual who was exiting the apartment that Mr. Clark was in. So I think the trial counsel basically argued not that you should acquit him because the evidence is circumstantial, but more, you know, and you're a former public defender, Your Honor. A lot of times in trial, we're basically arguing the state hasn't met their burden, you know, which is sort of the last chance you have in some cases. And I think that's really what she was arguing, just sort of like the state hasn't proven that he entered. He was the individual that entered. He was the individual that took the Blu-ray player. It was found in a little girl's backpack, in an apartment that at least three people shared.
I thought it was found in his bedroom.
No.
DVD, DVR player that had the same serial number.
No, there was documents found in the bedroom, which I think the police used to demonstrate that he had occupancy in the apartment.
Okay.
But the DVD player was actually found in a little girl's backpack, I think in like a hall closet. So, again, you have a woman that was living in the apartment, I guess that was...
So they recovered the DVD player from a little girl's backpack where...
I believe it was recovered from the backpack was in a hall closet.
In his apartment?
It was actually his wife's apartment or girlfriend's apartment. There's some question about whether he actually lived there. Yes, they did find documentation which would suggest that he was staying there or at least occupying the apartment. But there was a number of people that lived there. I believe his wife or girlfriend's daughter and her boyfriend lived there with a small child as well. Again, you know, there's a bunch of people here. Ms. Turvey was not watching this whole thing go down. If you remember her testimony, at one point she was taking a shower. She was inside. She was waiting for her husband to get home. So, you know, it'd be one thing if she kind of watched the whole thing happen, but she didn't. And she's sort of speculating as to who did what and whatever. And You know, and quite frankly, I believe the police had an obligation to at least question the other individual as well. And I think that because he was the individual on the second floor with Mr. Clark, I mean, there's certainly probable cause to detain him, or at least reasonable suspicion to question him. Now, the second thing, I think, and that's perhaps what this court is most interested in, I don't know, is this issue with Judge Vega amending the JOC after Mr. Clark began serving his sentence and after we had filed a notice of appeal in this particular case. So, as Your Honors are aware, we have jurisdictional issues with the various courts in this state. And once the notice of appeal is filed, that this court has exclusive jurisdiction over the case. Now, there's some statutes and case law which suggest that the district court will retain jurisdiction in limited circumstances to correct an illegal sentence, to correct a sentence that was based on... I kind of want to save my rebuttal time, and I apologize, but if Your Honors want me to keep going, I will.
I want to hear the
okay.
Answer.
So then there's the mistaken assumption about his criminal record, which works to the defendant's extreme detriment, or clerical errors, or those sort of things. Now, and I apologize I didn't include this in the brief, but I did come across a case post-briefing, Edwards, I believe it's Edwards versus State, 918 P2D 321, and it talks about, I think it sort of sets a rule that it says, because the nature of remedy sought in a motion for relief from sentence that is either facially illegal or the result of mistaken assumption regarding criminal defendant's record, time constraints and procedural defaults necessarily do not apply. But it doesn't mention clerical errors there. So, this court has jurisdiction over the case. I believe that pursuant to Edwards, if Judge Vega had sentenced him, let's say, on burglary to 6 to 10 years, which would be an illegal sentence in Nevada, I believe that, notwithstanding the fact that the notice of appeal had been filed, she could correct that. Additionally, I think if something came out that the PSI maybe contained like an incorrect like prior conviction that the attorney found out after the fact, I think the attorney could put it back on calendar, have her correct that, notwithstanding the fact that this court has jurisdiction. But when you're dealing with issues of quote-unquote clerical errors, which, I mean, only the district court judge knows whether that was truly a clerical error, because as Your Honors are aware, oral pronouncement of sentence doesn't mean anything until the JOC is filed. And I believe that's the, I want to say that's Miller versus Hayes, where a judge has complete ability to change their mind from the time that they orally pronounce sentence on the bench to when they sign the JOC. So now we've got a situation where Judge Vega says one thing at sentencing, and admittedly, I'm not denying the fact that the record is clear that she said you are sentenced under the small habitual. I agree with that. I'd be a fool to suggest that that's not what was said. But when you look at Miller, that who knows? You know, there was a time period between the oral pronouncement of sentence and when when NDOC sends a letter to Judge Vega saying, we got a problem here. Your JOC says, you know, 5 to 15 years, but it's burglary and home invasion, and that's illegal. And then she kind of handwrites the reference to the statute for the habitual criminal, but we'd already filed the notice of appeal. So, and here's the situation. Foster versus Dingwall, I think, is an important case, and I think that it probably should apply in situations that we have here, because here's one of the reasons why. I spent a pretty significant portion of my brief on an issue that, if it's truly a clerical error, was kind of a waste of time. And, you know, you can fault me for that, but at the same time, I think I'm looking through the record, and I'm trying to litigate every conceivable issue for Mr. Clark to give him any possible relief. I think an appellate attorney has that duty. I see this, and I decide, like, well, that's a problem, because, you know, I'm aware of the jurisdictional like differences. So I think in order to get everyone on the same page, Foster suggests, look, once the judgment is on appeal, and there's issues with the judgment on appeal, and notwithstanding the fact that there's, like, I guess, collateral things that you can kind of do, and there's correcting a legal sentence, there's correcting a mistake of fact, if you're seeking to modify the judgment significantly, and I think in this case that's a pretty significant modification, because the executive had the power at that point to do what it wanted with Mr. Clark, when you're seeking to modify that, get all the parties in court, certify your intent to do it if you want to this court, so this court can say to the district court, we agree, that's what you're going to do, we're not going to waste anyone's time with like a non-issue on appeal. And because of Foster's holding, the court could always say, you know what, I'm not going to modify this. Let's let the Supreme Court, who has the jurisdiction over the case, figure it out. They can certainly deny any motion that's filed. But if MDOC wanted to file a motion saying, you need to fix this JOC, and Judge Vega wanted to do that, she certainly could have certified her intent to this court, said, look, it wasn't a clerical error. That was, you know, that was an inadvertent mistake on my part, your justices. And my intent is to grant the NDOC's motion. I think having not done that, we have problems. And I just think, does that ultimately get Mr. Clark some relief? I don't know. I hope so. But I understand it's more of a jurisdictional issue, sort of legal technicality than substantively. And I'll save the rest of my guys 10 seconds for rebuttal.
Actually, since Justice Cherry asked you a specific question and asked you to carry on, I'm going to give you two additional minutes, and Mr. Smith, I'll give you two additional minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Appreciate that.
Morning, Justices. I'm Tyler Smith. I'm prosecutor with the Clark County District Attorney's Office representing the state of Nevada. With regards to the bails instruction, I agree with Justice Douglas. Whether or not Judge Vega ruled because this is not a correct statement of Nevada law or this is from California, I actually don't recall arguing that, but if that's what the record shows, I guess that's what I argued. Nevada law is clear. Bail says if the jury is instructed on reasonable doubt, given the proper instruction, it is not error for the judge to refuse to give this two interpretations instruction. And I would argue, Justices, that, I mean, this two interpretations instruction has two extreme problems with it. Number one, first we tell the jury, look, there's circumstantial evidence and there's direct evidence. And the trial judge usually mentions this at the beginning of the case when they're giving their preliminary instructions, and they instruct them at the end of the case. There is no difference. The law makes no distinction between either direct evidence and circumstantial evidence. And you...
Preliminary instructions given to the jury?
I don't recall specifically. No. It's typical...
They don't give them. We don't give the preliminary instructions to the jury. So that argument is really not true.
Well, I have heard many district court judges, and I don't recall Judge Vega this, but oftentimes they will give... And I know Judge Adair does, because I've done several trials in her court. They will give a preliminary speech or what have you to the jury saying, and there's also direct and circumstantial evidence, and they give the rain example or what other examples that the judges typically give. But at any rate, we tell them definitely at the end of the trial that there's no difference between the two. You are allowed to give whatever weight you wish to these particular types of evidence. Then we have this instruction, which comes along and basically contradicts that. It says, well, circumstantial evidence is different now. If you see two reasonable interpretations, you must give more weight to a reasonable interpretation which points towards innocence. And so I think that just confuses the jury. So wait a second, you just told me there's no difference.
Well, if I were DA too, I would not want that instruction given, because it's, you know, when I practiced in the early 70s, we gave it all the time. We got it all the time. Nobody raised an issue on it. Why? What's the fear of the district attorney of giving somebody a shot to maybe to let a jury decide whether there's two reasonable theories?
Well, there's the issue is whether or not we're confusing this jury on what their role in deciding what evidence, to how to look at the evidence. And you don't want a jury being confused after seeing it's up to me what weight I give this evidence, and now all of a sudden it's really not, according to the judge. And we also go on to another problem where legislature mandates this is the only... The definition of reasonable doubt that we give to the juries, this is the only definition that's to be used. It's not to be expounded upon. It's not to be given, you're not supposed to weigh it. You're not supposed to give examples. This is it. This is all you get. And now we have another instruction that's being requested all the time. It's requested in almost every trial. Some judges give it, some don't. But now we're quantifying reasonable doubt with this instruction. Now we're saying...
I think we said in our order that... if you give it, you got to give the complete Calgic instruction on it.
That's correct. In that particular order, that's what was ordered. I still believe that even if you give the complete Calgic instruction, that is not only now confusing the jury, but we're also using it to quantify reasonable doubt instead of using the very specific instruction and definition that's been given by the legislature. And in this particular case, we went over the facts a little bit, or Mr. Waters did. This was not just a case where he was standing outside this window. He was actually, and if you read the record, Don Turvey saw him what looked to be like his hands on the window, one hand on the window itself and one towards the, because the window was actually cracked a little bit and had a stopper that Mr. Herring, who was the occupant of the apartment, had tightened down because he'd actually been broken into a couple weeks before. And it looked to her as if he was trying to get into that apartment. So she goes back into her own apartment and she starts hearing noises. She comes out, kind of looks around to see what's going on, and she sees the defendant, who she knows. Now, the defendant, she'd had many interactions with him. He was staying in the apartment next to hers with a woman by the name of San Juanita Vega, and there was a man by the name of Charles Brown who was also living in that apartment. But she had conversations with him. So this is not some sort of mistaken identity. She knew him. And she sees him walking towards the steps which go up to the apartment right above her with a pole in his hand. And then after that, she goes back into her own apartment, and she hears more banging. She comes out again, and now the light is on in Mr. Herring's apartment. So to say that there's, I mean, it is circumstantial evidence. It's at least direct evidence that he was trying to get into that apartment. So whether or not he went in, he either went in himself or he attempted to go in or helped somebody go in, because that particular DVD player, which was Mr. Herring's, because Mr. Herring still had the manual with the serial number, the officers matched it up, was found in the apartment that not only Don Turvey knew Mr. Clark Bates that was staying in, that they also found identifications as well.
Well, that doesn't sound like circumstantial evidence to me. Maybe that instruction wasn't even applicable in this case.
Well, and I would agree, because while she never did see him in the apartment, nobody did. He clearly either went in himself or was party to going into that apartment, which is where the conspiracy theory and aiding and abetting liability came in.
When was the DVD player actually found? I'm confused on that point. There's indications, that we saw that it was in his own bedroom. Okay, so that's
incorrect. Mr. Waters was correct. It was found inside a backpack. It was a little girl's backpack, and he had like a Barbie. It was pink, inside a closet of that particular apartment that Mr. Clark was staying in. It was his ID, et cetera, I believe, which they used to identify him as an occupant. That was found in a bedroom.
Okay.
But, yes, the backpack itself was found in a hall closet right out. It wasn't a very big apartment, right outside the bedroom where the items were found.
Okay. Thank you.
And if the justices have any more questions on that issue, I'll move on to the...
Correcting the judgment of conviction, how should we do this? If you were me and you have to write this, how would you write it? Should we send it back just to have it fixed correctly?
I don't believe so, because the statute which permits the court to do this, which is 176.565, states that it may be done at any time. And in my opinion, that gives the district court jurisdiction to do that, whether a notice of appeal has been filed or not. And I think the intent there is because Mr. Clark was then sent to prison. And he's serving prison time on a judgment of conviction which has the incorrect statute. So the issue is, do we just leave him there under an incorrect judgment of conviction while this court looks at the issue, or can we just go ahead and fix it? And in this case, it's, as Mr. Waters said, it's clear that the intent of Judge Vega was to adjudicate him under the habitual statute. Certified judgments of convictions were filed, and she went over the specific convictions and the fact that the defendant was represented by counsel in each one of those convictions. The notice was filed. She clearly stated on the record that this is what is her intent. This is what the sentence should be. And, in fact, that's the sentence that was given in the judgment of conviction. The only thing missing was the correct statute. And that's a clerical error. That's an omission. That's a mistake that did not follow Judge Vega's intent. when she signed it, because typically the clerks are the ones who prepare those, and when she signed it, she just must have missed it, and it was fixed. And so it was corrected, so Mr. Clark is now serving a sentence based upon the correct statute, and the Nevada Department of Corrections now knows exactly what it is to be doing with Mr. Clark.
So I mean, we don't even, under your view, we don't even need to remand this for the district court to correct and wait for our remitter so the district court would have absolute jurisdiction to do that.
That's correct, Your Honor. For the specific reason the statute says at any time. It doesn't qualify it at all. And in fact, it says after notice to be given, if any. And it doesn't even mandate that the district court give notice to the parties in order to correct a clerical error. So I don't believe that a remitter needs to be issued in order for the court to do this. Because especially when it's clear in the transcript and at the time of the sentencing that this is what the intent of the district court was. If it's unclear, then we have a problem because then we're changing a sentence which isn't a clerical error or could be clearly defined as one.
You know, we've reversed civil cases where the judge says one thing and the judgment says something else and we've sent it back on that basis. Then you don't even have an issue of critical stage. I mean, sentencing is a critical stage. Why not just have it clean? Why are you so worried about it going back to clean it up? I've never, you know, why are you making an issue of it? I don't understand why the DA's office wouldn't want to go back, clean it up, send it, and do it right.
Well, I would argue, Justice Cherry, that it was cleaned up and it was done right.
So what if she changed it the other way? What if she changed it from habitual criminal to regular time? Would you be screaming then, saying, "Oh, look, you can't do that"? We filed an appeal was filed.
Well, in that instance, it's not a clerical error because she would be changing, Judge Vega would have been changing what the judgment of conviction stated to something that she did not specifically
do. But that's not the rule is the judgment of conviction is what goes, not what the judge says. That's what I'm saying in civil. That's why we reverse civil cases all the time when they say one thing and then they sign something else.
Well, I would just refer back to the statute, which indicates that they may correct a clerical error at any time. And the issue that becomes at that point, again, Mr. Clark is serving a sentence on a judgment of conviction, which in this case had that specific sentence, but all it was missing was the specific statute for him to be sentenced under.
I just don't understand your position on that at all. To let it go back and be corrected the right way in front of a judge.
Well, it was
kind of chocolate and vanilla.
Well, and I would say, Justice Cherry, that it was done pursuant to the statute properly, the way the statute reads. That at any time, because we have NDOC saying, "Hey, what are we supposed to do here? What the judgment of conviction is incorrect. We don't know what statute you sentenced him under." And under the statute, Judge Vega, which says at any time, may correct that, and that's what she did.
So the filing of appeal really doesn't matter. The judge could change. As long as you're happy with it, you won't raise the issue, but God forbid they change that judgment of conviction, you'll be screaming.
Well, I would say as long as it's done in the proper manner, we have no reason to scream. And there are other statutes which permit a judge to hear issues before her or him, even though a notice of appeal has been filed. And one of those cases is petitions for DNA testing, for post-conviction DNA testing that was never done. And the statute, and that says this remedy is in addition to any other remedy or is not excluded by anything else. And so even if a judgment of conviction has been filed, the state can't come in and say, "Well, wait a second, you don't have jurisdiction to hear this petition for DNA testing because this is on appeal." The legislature has given other issues or judges the ability to hear matters and to do things even though a notice of appeal may have been filed.
Was that judgment of conviction an illegal sentence?
It was not an illegal sentence in the sense that there was
a clerical error. That's a yes or no.
If Judge Vega sentenced only under, had not adjudicated as a habitual criminal, then yes, that would be a legal sentence, clearly, because it is beyond what the legislature has prescribed for a burglary and or a home invasion conviction. But the sentence that Mr. Clark received when pronounced by the judge...
And I'm telling you that pronounced doesn't mean anything. The judgment of conviction rules, not what the judge says. It has to be You have to sign the judgment of conviction. I signed them for 8 years, so I know what I'm talking about.
And I agree with you. But the judge may also correct a judgment of conviction, which is what happened in this case. And I have nothing further unless justices have any questions.
No, I got nothing else.
Oh, good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Well, let me put it on you now. Why is it so important that we go back and correct this? I mean, we know what this guy's going to get. It's not like it's going to be a surprise to the district attorney's office.
I know. And sometimes you're a victim of your own, like, ambition, I guess. But I do think there's an important point here, though, that just sort of comes up. And I listened to Mr. Smith talk about the statute that says at any time. It can be corrected at any time if it's truly a clerical error. But here's the problem. We have no record from Judge Vega that says, you know what, that was a clerical error. We have no record of that whatsoever. The amended JOC was just handwritten with the statutory, the reference to the habitual criminal statute. Mr. Smith is presuming that it was a clerical error, but as Your Honor pointed out over and over and over again, oral pronouncement means nothing. It's not until it's signed. And she signed it without reference to the habitual criminal statute. So now we're going to get into a situation where we as attorneys and you as the Supreme Court are going to speculate as to what the judge was thinking, whether she changed her mind, whether it was merely a clerical error. There's no record whatsoever that this is what happened.
Mr. Waters, would you like to roll the dice and have it go back and have the court treat it as a big habitual opposed to the little?
Well, obviously not. I think, you know, and I didn't litigate that, and I would obviously have to look into that, Your Honor, but, you know.
I asked you the question in light of what Justice Sherry is putting forth, that what the court enumerated from the bench has no real merit or place. I happen to think it does. I disagree with him on that point because, as I said, if not, if we just take that and completely void it out, then the judge is free to come back on this and put before you and say, well, I made a mistake, I'm going to resentence, and now I'm going to consider.
And there might be a constitutional problem with a resentencing where the parties aren't in court and you're not represented by, like, your public defender and so forth. Because I think sentencing, as I think Justice Cherry pointed out, is a very critical state of the proceeding. If it's truly a resentencing, to give them
should we just leave this alone and let the defendant have to make a motion to correct an illegal sentence?
Well, here's what I would suggest, and I know this is going to shock everyone, but it was an illegal sentence. We filed a notice of appeal. Your Honors have jurisdiction, complete and total jurisdiction over this case at this point. I argued in my opening brief that it's an illegal sentence. I believe this panel has the power to say to Judge Vega, correct the illegal sentence. It cannot be 5 to 15 years. It has to be within the range for burglary or home invasion. I understand that's sort of like hoping to win the lottery, but I do think that there's something important about following the proper procedures, not making appellate attorneys and justices of the Supreme Court kind of speculate as to what you may or may not be thinking. Mack Manley, the Mack Manley case, basically talks about issues that are collateral to the proceedings that are allowed to be changed at any time. I would hope Mr. Smith would agree with me that whether or not he is a habitual criminal or not, or whether it was proper, whether it was an illegal sentence, is not collateral to the judgment of conviction that is currently before Your Honors. I appreciate your time. Is there any other questions?
I don't have any colleagues.
Nope.
Thank you. All right. Well, thank you both for your very good arguments today. We appreciate it. This matter will stand submitted, and the case will